George W. Bush will be the 43rd chief executive to deliver an inaugural address. Reportedly, he will be brief, perhaps about 12 minutes. But Mr. Bush is not expected to be history's most concise inaugural speaker. That distinction goes to George Washington, whose second inaugural address ran two paragraphs, just about as long as the sales pitch from a long-distance telephone company. Now, over this nation's 224-year history, several chief executives have made an inaugural speech only once, others twice. Franklin D. Roosevelt made four inaugural addresses, the most of any president. Some presidents have written them in their own hand, others have been extensive collaborations, still others have been the work of a single speechwriter, whose name later slips from history. But a president's inaugural remarks, whether lofty, colloquial, eloquent, or eloquently plain, are often used as the measure against which they're judged for years to come. Patrick Maney teaches political history at the University of South Carolina. He has studied past inaugurals and joins us from the studios of WLTR in Columbia, South Carolina. Professor, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
And has the goal of an inaugural address subtly or not so subtly changed over the years?
I think it's been pretty much the same from the beginning. The inaugural address really gives the new president, for the first time, a chance to define himself before the nation and the world. And I think that was what George Washington was trying to do, and I think that's still what presidents do.
And to what degree do you have some presidents used it as an opportunity to lay out an agenda for action? The kind of thing against, by the way, they can be measured.
Well, I think actually, although if you really look at and read inaugural addresses, most of them are pretty forgettable. And even presidential historians would be really hard-pressed to come up with more than three or four passages of really that are worth remembering. But I think they can be surprisingly, in retrospect, revealing. They do really indicate, more often than not, what kind of a president we will have and what his administration will be like. For example, activist presidents like Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, quite clearly signaled their intentions on Inauguration Day. On the other hand, Warren G. Harding, Calvin Coolidge, Dwight Eisenhower let it be known that they weren't really planning to shake things up.
Maybe the answer to this is unknowable, but to the best of your knowledge, who is the last president to have substantially written his own inaugural address?
My guess is that Herbert Hoover would have been the last president who sat down and wrote it himself, and his is not a particularly memorable address.
Professor, have you ever had occasion to read over the inaugural addresses of say, James K. Polk or Rutherford B. Hayes? People who are not, I think it's fair to say, considered among our most distinguished presidents, and notice a phrase that stays with you, something you admire?
Well, let me tell you, I think in looking back at them, there were a couple of surprises for me. Let me read you a passage, if I
sure.
can, from an inaugural address. No man can be fully free while his neighbor is not. To go forward at all is to go forward together. This means black and white together, as one nation, not two. The laws have caught up with our conscience. What remains is to give life to what is in the law, to ensure at last that as all are born equal in dignity before God, all are born equal in dignity before man. Any guess as to the author of that?
I will guess Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Nixon.
Well,
and it's
you catch me there.
So, and there are other sentiments that come from presidents that we have forgotten or that we would not identify with the idea. Another one in terms of racial justice that really struck me was James Garfield, who died within months of his inauguration. But he said in, and this was maybe the most sort of compelling case that any president has made in an inaugural for racial justice, he said that the abolition of slavery and the enfranchisement of African Americans was the single most important political development since the adoption of the Constitution. And
well, what year was this, Professor?
this was 1881.
Mm-hmm.
And he also said that to deny ex-slaves the vote under for any excuse was a crime which could wreck the Union. At the time, Southern states were trying to undo the guarantees to vote of the 15th Amendment, and under the pretext that ex-slaves lacked the education to make informed judgments. And what Garfield said was that, well, bad government is an evil, and it's something that should be corrected. But to deny people the right to vote and their other rights of citizenship is even worse. That's a crime. And I don't think any other president made so passionate and coherent a plea for racial justice as Garfield. And yet he's a president that we don't remember, and we don't think of his words very often.
Let me ask about Franklin Roosevelt's fourth inaugural. As memory serves, I've seen the newsreels. I was not around at the time. Did he not request, he said, I beg your indulgence, let me remain seated?
Well, that was actually when he, a short time later, a month later, when he returned from Yalta Conference and addressed a joint session of Congress, when for the very first time in public he made reference to his disability. Actually, during the inauguration, he spoke from the portico of the White House, but he stood during the address. And at that time, I mean, it's really a kind of a sad event in a way, because Roosevelt, by January 1945, was a dying man. He had a gray pallor, blue lips. He had a tremor. He was sometimes slipping off in the middle of a sentence. But yet, when he gave this address, he sort of rallied. I mean, he had this remarkable ability to rise to the occasion. And so just 10 minutes earlier, I think some of the people around him were wondering whether he would be able to even go on, whether they might have to delay or even postpone the inaugural address. But such was not the case. I mean, when he was wheeled out to the portico and then when he stood and was helped to the podium, it was like he came to life again.
From your perspective, what are you hoping to hear from George W. Bush as he's inaugurated president?
I think there has to be some acknowledgement of the kind of unusual circumstances by which he takes office. I think he will have to do some reaching out to Vice President Gore and to the Democrats, because there are a lot of people who are disturbed as never before about the circumstances of the election. Having said that, however, I think it will also be in his interest to sort of take possession of the office, to reach out, but also to establish himself. Because if he does that, and if he fills up the office, I think the disputed nature of the election will mostly be a subject for historians rather than the public.
Professor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Patrick Maney heads the History Department at the University of South Carolina, speaking from the studios of WLTR in Columbia.